We're going to be studying two different authors tonight. One I've mentioned in the past, and that's Gila Mandelson. And her book is called Head to Heart. And the other is Sarah Chana Radcliffe. Both are psychologists. And on the topic we want to address tonight, they have different perspectives. I wouldn't say there are contradictions. I think it could all be integrated. And what I tried to do in this handout is give you a little bit from here, a little bit from there. After we do the introduction, which is page 1 and page 2, you'll already get the hang of it as to how I put this all together, and you'll know which one is Mandelson and which one is Radcliffe, you know, just by the font, you know, but more than the font, also the topic and the perspective, the language. Okay. Now, on the front cover, I added a piece from the Tiferes Shlomo by way of introduction. His poetry in describing Almighty God is something that I think we have to take to heart and puts our whole discussion tonight in Mirtz Hashem into a Torah perspective. He speaks about Hashem in the following way. Hine yodua midas tuvo shel boreinu yisbarach shmo. He's focusing on the goodness of God. Shehu noach lirtzos. Ritzui means he wants a relationship. And he's very calm about that, very straightforward, very eager to invite us to come close to him. And the Tiferes Shlomo expands upon this. He says, Ratzolomar afim kfar koas. Sometimes we incur, unfortunately, divine anger and wrath because of our failings, our misdeeds. And God has already gotten angry, so that's a done deal. Whatever we did, we did. Nipa'aleinu, because of our actions. Nevertheless, even so, hu noach lirtzos, achar kach. Later on, he's easy to be pacified. He's easy to wave and to be mochel. Hu misnachem u mischaret. Kaviyochel, God has nechama. He decides to regret what he did. And that, l'mafreya, he says, impacts on the kas that he had. The anger of God is removed retroactively, as if he never got angry at all. And why is that? Ki ritzono ach lehetiv. Because God has one interest and one goal. God is tov, and he wants to be meitiv. He wants to give good, to bestow kindness, mercy, and goodness on all of us. And therefore, if you take a look at the statement of Abba Shaul, which appears all over the place, I just chose one because I happen to like the formulation of the Yalkut. He says, Havidomolo, we should imitate God. And that means imitatio Deo, Mahu Rachum V'chanun, Afato Rachum V'chanun. I feel very strongly that this statement, together with the Tiferes Shlomo, puts our entire discussion tonight into a definite perspective. What better advice could we give to someone who's looking for a marriage partner, who's dating, or a couple in marriage, in the framework of marriage, parents who are raising children, and all the above? This, I think, is the credo. This is the policy that we have to take most to heart. To imitate God, to be easily pacified, and even if we get angry, and we may have good reason to, nevertheless, to regret that anger retroactively as if there was never a kas to begin with. And tonight, we want to discuss a category of men called gentlemen. And who is a gentleman? What is a gentleman? A gentleman is a gentleman. And that means he's soft-spoken, he's humble, he strives for character perfection with the wisdom and the guidance of Chazal, of the great Bali Musar, our sages. He's slow to anger, but if he does get angry, He's quick to recover. He's kasha lichos, but noach l'ratzos. He's patient, he's forgiving, compassionate, and caring.
It sounds what we want from God.
Exactly.
It's in our prayer.
This is what we're asking from God, and this is how we want to imitate God. And tonight's discussion will focus on how we can achieve that goal in our lives, each and every one of us, of becoming this kind of a personality, caring, compassionate, to identify with the needs of our loved ones, whether it's parents and children, children parents, whether it's a spouse, whatever it may be, to be compassionate, to be giving, to be forgiving. And everything we're going to do tonight, as I said at the outset, studying the writings of two different psychologists that we're going to integrate into one whole, everything really should lead us to understand that the success of our endeavors depends upon this obligation to imitate God. Mahu rachum afatora. And what we're going to focus on tonight is creating a family unit. And I don't think we've gotten a chance in the past to discuss this, to focus on it. I always like to quote Rav Moshe Chaim Litzato's introduction to his Mesilat Yesharim. Everything he says that I'm going to present to you is simple, it's well known, it's fundamental, but we have to review it over and over and over again. And I have to tell you, my friends, and I thank again everyone for coming tonight, that when I read this, and I hope we'll read it together and study it, a lot of scenarios that we can throw around. We spoke about the triple A's last time. Tonight we're going to speak about the triple C's, you know, the compassion that we need, the caring. What we have to consider is that these writings have an emotional impact on us. I hope they'll have an impact on you as they do on me. Because to me, even though we're studying psychology tonight, this is a great Musar Shmooz. And sometimes when we study Musar, we do so in a kind of an ivory tower complex or context, and ideas are very highfalutin. Sometimes they even shed a light on the parsha that we read in the Torah. I like to give parsha shirim with hashkafa and Musar. But here, even though, and maybe dafka because we're dealing with real life issues, especially in contemporary society, and we're dealing with painful issues in marriage conflict, in breakdowns in communication, in emotional dysfunction, nevertheless, this is Musa for all of us. Now, some of us sitting here in the room are absolute tzaddikim, and they're perfect, and they're righteous, and they're compassionate, and caring, and they're giving to their spouse, and maybe they don't need this. But even if they don't, I think ein tzaddik ba'aretz asher lo yaseh ra. Each one of us has our own failings, our own, you know, our own faults, and I think we're all going to find something in here that we can relate to, and perhaps purify ourselves, sanctify ourselves in those areas. So we're going to start with the painful part of tonight's discussion, and that is abuse. Abuse is tragically a phenomenon that has become so common and so widespread to the point in which it's penetrating even the most orthodox circles. And we're going to begin with Mandelson in the first paragraph, and then compare almost identically Radcliffe in the second paragraph. They both point out that this is a problem that has to be addressed. But yet, they both ask us to define what is abuse, what causes abuse, and how can we correct the problem of abuse. So in the first paragraph, this is a concern in the Jewish world. Despite the fact that our marriages are predicated, as all our lives, on solid foundations, both in halacha, in musar, in hashkafa. Nevertheless, somehow we failed. But in the next and last sentence in this paragraph, which means a lot to me, and I hope it does to you, she is going to give us her perspective. What do we have to study? And why is it important for us to understand and appreciate head-on, face-to-face, the problem of abuse? And the answer is, and here I'm addressing myself primarily to singles who are dating, but also to married couples who are guiding people and helping people find their marriage partners. Within the context of dating, she claims, there are ways of identifying abuse potential where a problem might arise. We'll come right back to Mendelsohn in a minute, but first, let's fast forward to Radcliffe. She says that you can describe in poetic terms what the gleam in the eyes of Akala as she stands with her groom, her husband-to-be, under the chuppah. She's absolutely excited. She's enthralled. She can't wait to begin to establish her marriage on the basis of what she considers Torah Hashkafa, a steadfast Torah home. She's eager to create that family. Tragically, in many cases, all too many cases, these young women find, and it breaks the heart, that her husband, their husbands, each respectively, of course, are suffering from an abuse, that she is suffering from an abusive relationship. Okay, now, we're going to ask the question, what is it that causes a person, in this case a husband, to be abusive? And then we'll see how to define abusive behavior. The causes are twofold. The first is what I call insecurity. The psychologists tell us, and again, there's some debate about the extent of the profound influence of early childhood on the development of a personality, but be that as it may, all of psychology embraces the fact that a child is impacted from a very young age by what he or she sees in the house in which he or she is growing up in. Chazal tell us that even a baby barisa, still in the carriage, in the cradle, can be brought to the positive environment of a Beit Midrash and can be impacted by the Kol Torah, the voice of Torah. So that we see that children are so impressionable.
Susceptible.
And therefore, what happens to a child, unfortunately, is that in a certain kind of a home, which we'll see, that child is developing without a positive sense of self. And, as a result, deep-seated feelings of inferiority, which generates a certain element of self-hatred and sensitivity. As a result, this child, growing up, reaching adulthood, will look almost starving to find any opportunity to build himself up because he feels so subjugated and so inferior. How does he do that? By pushing someone else down, by abusing someone, whether it be physical abuse or emotional abuse. Please note those terms. I would even underline that because we're going to come back to that categorization of these two categories of abuse. On the one hand, physical abuse, which some might claim is the more severe and profound kind of abuse, but perhaps others would argue that emotional abuse, as we'll see this express itself, is a phenomenon that's even more damaging and more dangerous. Abusive personalities are found in both genders, male or female. Perhaps males, future husbands, are more susceptible to becoming abusive in a marriage relationship. Maybe that's because of the male ego, because the male thinks that he can control others. Male thinks that he has to assert himself. Whatever it might be, these are factors that play in. And the bottom line is, we're talking out of a sense of inferiority about an abusive personality. Now, we're going back to Radcliffe. And look what she says, which you'll find on the bottom of your page one. Something very similar to what we've seen until now. We're not talking about individuals who are mentally ill, but we're talking about people who engage in these kinds of abusive behaviors. Number one, controlling. Number two, intimidating. Number three, mind-destroying and abusive. And we're going to get into each one of these terms in Mirtz Hashem. These are people who are not mentally ill. You would not necessarily say that, you know, they need extreme, profound psychiatric help. But yet, they enter into a relationship and exhibit abusive behavior. In many cases, and we ask why people act cruelly, when there doesn't seem to be any health reason for it, the first answer is that the root of abusive behavior is a result of, and watch this phrase, it's a very important phrase, I would underline it, emotional vulnerability. A child raised in a home which is abusive, which lacks communication, will inevitably become vulnerable. His or her emotional stability and intelligence has not been developed properly. And as a result, a painful childhood, and those are very heavy terms. I don't know if any of you have seen various documentaries or psychological films. I don't know if anyone here has studied psychology. But you'll always see in these films the pain that a child suffers in early childhood, which engenders a deep feeling of insecurity. What happens as a result of insecurity? What becomes extremely frequent are feelings of shame. Imagine an individual who feels shame about himself or herself. And this is a result of a painful childhood. Five. What caused this pain in the child as the child was growing up? First of all, it may have been pain that he suffered at the hands of his own parents, who themselves were abusive to him. Or it may be that he was bullied by others. Again, bullied both physically or emotionally, it matters not at this point. Siblings, other family members, it could be even teachers. And what happens as a result is this person has to puff himself up. He feels down. He feels painfully insecure, shameful of himself. Imagine, he may not be guilty, but when he suffers those slings and arrows that people bully him, he blames himself. His personality is scarred. It's so tragic. And as a result, he looks desperately for any way of building himself up. And therefore, what does he do? He fights back. He attacks a woman who should be his best friend and is his best friend. And he accuses her. Maybe she forgot to do something, we're turning now to page two. Or perhaps she didn't remember something that he told her. And these are things that happen all the time in marriage. Perhaps she decided, she has a mind of her own, to do things her way and not his way. Maybe she was impatient with him. Maybe she made a comment that was unkind. So her criticism now makes him feel shameful. He's got to find a mechanism, something to fight back. He's already low and down on himself, suffering from shame as it was as a result of a painful childhood. He himself was abused in his childhood, and now he's got to fight back. But it's like someone who steps on your toe, well, ever so gently, but if your toe is red because it's injured, you're going to hit the ceiling. And so he responds in a very extreme way. Those extreme responses are typical of an abusive individual. They fight back, they spring back, they fight in order to abuse someone because they themselves were abused. It's what Chazal speak about a pasuk in Mishlei, Kemayim Ponim El Ponim. They're simply fighting back. It's sort of like a person who's so sensitive that he's got his defense mechanisms up and constantly sees experiences and relationships or interactions as being a threat. His very psychological well-being is threatened. And as a result, he responds with excessive rage. That, my friends, is the most telling symptom of an abusive individual. Someone who cannot control anger. And we've discussed this in the past when we went through Rabbi Aaron Feldman's book, and he writes so much on rage control.
Yeah.
We discussed conflict resolution in order to resolve those conflicts, how important it is to control anger, to find a quiet, controlled environment to do so. And in a sense, he's making a statement, not verbally, he's not expressing this, that never again will I suffer abuse. I'm going to go to whatever extreme. I'm going to get angry at anyone who threatens me because I was put down and now I've got to defend myself. He can never again face suffering the same kind of humiliation and helplessness he felt as a child. And therefore, his aggressive posture is going to bring down his marriage. And she calls it traumatic divorce. I think what she means by traumatic divorce is there are amicable divorces, but generally speaking, when it comes to abusive relationships, it's hard to even imagine an amicable divorce. It's going to be traumatic. All this is a result of a cycle, almost an avalanche, of A causes B and B back to A, a circle in which the child was abused. The child felt the pain, the emotional fragility, and now, because he's so fragile emotionally, he swings back when no one is threatening him. He envisions in his mind. It's like, you know, you hit a fly with a hammer. You know, that's what he's doing. And whatever his wife does, he perceives it as threatening. That kind of extreme rage and aggressive behavior is indicative of abuse, and that's what we're talking about. It's painful, but this has become too common in our lives. Going back to Mandelson, she says the following. Very important point, which you'll see in the middle of page 2. It's very important, she says, to distinguish between what she calls a disorder and a defect. A defect. A psychological disorder, in the case of an abusive person, Rachmana Litzlan, is something that needs professional help. No question about it. But we don't have to throw in the towel on other individuals who have character defects. We all have character defects. But sometimes those character defects express themselves all too frequently in marriage, and they have to be addressed. It doesn't mean we have to throw in the towel. We're not talking about a disorder. We're talking about a defect. These are people who behave occasionally, and maybe even more than occasionally, in an abusive way. But nevertheless, they look at themselves objectively. In other words, they are fully aware of the abusive behavior that they've been exhibiting, and they want to do whatever they can to do tshuva, to correct themselves, to rectify the situation. They feel remorse. They want to change. They're willing to go for help in order to control these issues. And therapy might be very useful unless the wounds and the pains of childhood are too deep. And then something more radical might be needed. Why didn't she notice this before she married him? She went into the chuppah, but maybe he himself didn't exhibit these behaviors because he was never under pressure. to any great extent. Yeah, he took his high school exams and his college finals and everything else. But what happens in marriage as you build a family is there's a great deal of tension in that process of building up a family, and especially within the context of the finances. And we've discussed this on many occasions, how money issues can sometimes trigger off finances. If he, for example, lost his job, and we know that in contemporary society this is all too commonplace, he's in a very sensitive position. He's low on himself, and therefore he may respond with anger. So now she finds herself post-chuppah in this relationship. I'm almost finished with the introduction, and we're almost about to answer the following question. And that is, although both of these authors are addressing the issue of abuse, they each have a different focal point, a different approach or attitude towards abuse. And this we'll see when we get to the bottom of this page.
Both women.
Women are great psychologists. They have a lot to say about marriage, especially when they're blaming the husband. Okay, let's see common dysfunctional patterns in communication, in dysfunctional communication. This is 3/4 of the way down on page 2. Yelling, other aggressive, threatening, intimidating language, being bossy, disrespectful, insults, coarse language, physically aggressive, intimidating. Again, if this pattern is repeating itself over and over again, then we have at the very least a defect and maybe even a disorder. And until now we've discussed the inferiority that makes a man, as a result of his painful childhood, overly sensitive, in which he responds with rage which is totally out of perspective to the cause of his anger. But there's another form and another psychological situation which engenders abuse. And that's on the bottom of your page 2. These are people who are abusive simply because they care about themselves. They are totally self-centered. They are the bullies that maybe some of you remember from your childhood, as I do. When I was growing up in Brooklyn, there were a lot of them. Okay? These are people who grab, they take away from you. Maybe you had children in your class who used to do this. They push you out of this way. Sometimes you're playing a game and they don't play by the rules. They're strong-armed. And not only that, they frighten even their parents into submission. And this is going to be a tremendous problem because parents don't know how to deal with their little young children who are aggressive. In this case, it's not shame that motivates or engenders this kind of behavior that's abusive, but an unbridled desire to have things their way. I want it done my way. It's either my way or the highway. They are totally big on themselves. They're conceited. They're gasei ruach. We're going to read about them in Yitzchak Shem the Shabbos. We'll read Parshas Tazria. Those who are to contract the goyim, all the different forms of the goyim. All they care about is themselves. They have no empathy for feelings of others. And when it comes to their relationship with their wives, they don't put their wives, you know, we spoke about having mechaved es ishto yosef migufo. That doesn't appear on their page. They're not giving cover to their wives exceeding respect. And in this case, what they're lacking in terms of emotional intelligence really causes tremendous suffering for their partnership. And their partner wants to abandon the relationship. Again, it's not much of a relationship. We'll have to put it in inverted commas. And if you turn a little bit towards the side of your page, she concludes her presentation by saying that it doesn't matter which form or which cause creates this kind of abusive personality. It could be A, oversensitive, or B, insensitive. But at the end of the day, it's not something that happens overnight. These personalities, abusive, develop over the course of time. And therefore, she says, we've got to interrupt the process of a child growing up to be an abusive personality. The responsibility, she says, is primarily on the parents. And so when we talk about building a family unit, we're going to go back to the parents, and we're going to impose upon them a responsibility that's incumbent upon them to notice certain behavior patterns and respond in the right way. In order, the goal is to interrupt this process. And there are techniques, the goal of which is to develop in our sons a gentlemanly personality, sharing, caring, compassionate. So now, having completed our introduction, and we're ready to go on to the kishkes of it, as I say, to the substance, we can say the following. This book, Mandelson, is interested in dating. And that's what her book is all about, what you want to know about dating and before marriage. She's going to address herself to those who are going out to look for a marriage partner and try to give them clues. How to identify and avoid an abusive personality. That's her take on it. The approach of Mrs. Radcliffe, on the other hand, is a totally different one. She's interested in parents. She wants to get down to the root of things. Why is it that we are raising husbands in the Jewish world, it's a terrible thing, who are abusive? What can the parents do? Again, they can't guarantee that they'll succeed, but they have to make every effort to create that kind of a family in which the children are being raised to be compassionate, to be mahu rachum, afator rachum, and not to be abusive. Two different perspectives, answering two different questions. As you go on to page 3, you'll be able to see immediately who's saying what. Besides, as I said before, the difference in font. On the top of the page, you can guess who this is. How do we identify a potential abuser when you're dating? That's our approach. And in order to do so, what we have to learn, and it's very critical for those who are dating, to figure out what abusive personality traits you can identify as the red bell warning signal so that you don't find out too late. Drop it during the dating period. Drop it if you're engaged, even that's a lot better than divorce. And if need be, has shown divorce, but only in a very extreme abuse. Now, she's going to give us a number of cases of abusive behavior that you could already predict during the dating period, and you'll see it in marriage as well. And she's going to tell us the following. If you see 1, 2, maybe even 3 of these different phenomena, okay, that's what we would call some sort of personality defect. But it can be worked on. As long as the person is aware of it, the spouse is working on it, trying to do better and improve themselves. If, though, a number of these kinds of behaviors, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, appear and reappear, that's when the red bell has to go off. Okay, then? So that is what we're going to see here on the bottom of page 3. The first sign is going to be paranoia, as we discussed before. But now, I want to show you the approach of Mrs. Radcliffe. She's interested in understanding the relationship between parents and children, and how is it that children in our generation they grow up to be abusive spouses, abusive parents. And she tells us the following story. We don't know the name of the writer, but the writer says, "In my family, we all yelled." Sounds good. Maybe it's good to yell, right? Let's get it all out there, you know? Let's lift the burden from our chest. And it never meant anything. This was just the way we did it. We were a very loving family. But how did we deal with communication? By yelling, screaming. In my husband's family, everyone is tight-lipped. No one says a word. They like to avoid confrontation. So, we put these two people together, and we turned them into a cholent, and what do we get out of it? So she says the following. Personally, I don't like his approach. She was raised in her approach. She likes to yell. She likes the honest approach. Let's get it out. Out in the open, let's get it over. Let's fight each other. But my husband never got used to my style. And ultimately, unfortunately, he called me abusive and asked for a divorce. So it's very nice to yell and scream if it's good, but it's very dangerous. The risk here is very intense because you are raising a child in a way that ultimately he's going to respond, and his confrontational style might ultimately destroy a relationship.
Right.
And now we're going to talk about dating. Number one, the first way of identifying a potential abusive personality is paranoia. He falsely accuses you. He's afraid from left, right, and center who's behind him. Somebody's about to stab him in the back. He always defines himself as never a victim. They're out to get me. That's what we call paranoia. Anyone who has the most basic knowledge of psychology knows that there's something called a paranoid individual. And we're all a little bit paranoid, but when it gets to the point of an extreme that we're just responding because we think at the slightest provocation that someone is about to murder us. Now, you're in a dating situation. As we said many times, during dating, it's very critical to be observant. I don't mean frum, I mean observant in the sense, observe behavior, you know, be very careful about it. That's what it means to be frum in this context. Notice innocent mistakes. Analyze the personality. Does he take innocent mistakes personally? All of a sudden, he says, oh, I did this, I did that, I'm terrible, or something along that line. Or he jumps as soon as he perceives somebody's attacking him. So this girl goes out with a guy named Levi. Okay? A child ran into Levi. Yeah, he was playing with the ball. You've seen it. It happens all the time. Here it's more likely a dog than a child. But whatever it is. And he shoves the boy off and yells at him at the top of his lungs. Okay, that's one thing. Another scenario. Brad notices that Joanne, his date, is looking in the direction of another man. So right away, he jumps up. He accuses her of being interested in him. Okay, these are false accusations from a paranoid personality. Avigail shows up 5 minutes late for her date, and Shlomo says to her, I've been waiting for you. Did you do this purposely? The girl comes 5 minutes late. Again, I'm not giving her, I'm not giving her a great grade for that. It's nice to come on time, but Ribbono Shel Olam, 5 minutes late? That certainly doesn't deserve to incur any wrath. You know, if an avreich comes 5 minutes late to Kolel Chasvishalom, that deserves, the director of the program should just dock you from salary. And if you work in a company and they need every minute of it.
For the airport, 5 minutes late, that might be significant.
Yeah, that's right. You might end up in Malaysia or somewhere there. Over the Indian Ocean.
End up not in Malaysia.
Yeah, right. That's the problem. So if you date normal people, you date may occasionally wonder if someone has something against them. Occasionally you think somebody holds it in against you, especially in a competitive world that we live in.
What's your definition of normal?
So that's what I'm saying. Normally means occasionally you feel that someone has it in against you. I think Yisrael, that's normal. That's within the realm of normal.
It's not paranoid?
No, I don't think it's paranoid. Again, if it's occasional. If I walk around thinking that every single person is out to stab me in the back, that's not normal behavior. The fact that I go out with a young woman and she thinks that someone has it in against her, that doesn't mean that she's, paranoid. And therefore, that's not something that you have to be overly concerned about. Take a look, if you will, on page 4. Here we have another description of what we call an alarm bell that should go off.
That's right.
When you have it on page 4, I think. Are we up to page 4?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. This is it. We spoke about rage. We spoke about anger. Some people cannot control their anger. They're constantly frustrated. You'll see it all over the place. I meet these people constantly. It's unfortunate. It's tragic. People who are not happy with themselves. They're always angry. They're always ready to pounce on you. You'll see it when you're driving. You'll see it in the supermarket if you're waiting online. You know what I mean? All these 10 stressful situations, that's where it comes out. Mm-hmm. And they can't control their anger. Within a marriage situation, the man is hot-tempered. He doesn't know how to cope. He explodes easily. And sometimes, in the worst-case scenario, as a result of his rage, he reacts physically. And we know about battered wives. In dating, what do you see? What might be a sign, you know, a red bell signal? Sometimes you may see that in a situation of stress, he's impatient. We're all impatient. It is the sickness of our generation. This is contemporary society. We live in a society where everything moves very quickly. The Americans are the worst, by the way. The Brits, a half a notch lower. The Australians are very laid back. You know, that's what I'm finding out. I just met my future mechutanim. And, you know, I would have said 15 things in the time that it took them to say one thing. You know, because I'm American. You know, we're just impatient. You know, we don't have time. Nobody listens to anyone in America because we just, you know, get to the punchline. You know what I'm saying? So again, you know, some level or measure of impatience is within the realm of normal. However, if he overreacts, he gets aggressive, he gets aggravated, and watch him in traffic jams, watch him if something spills, you know, he's the waiter. Have you had this experience? How many people ever had an experience, again, I'm a lot older than you, so I've had it dozens of times, where the waiter does something that you're not happy with? They spill something on you. They didn't clean the table. It took them 40 hours to bring out a soup. You know what I'm saying? The whole bit. So how do you respond to that? You know, you can get up and literally, you know, strangle the guy. Or you can react within a normal kind of response. How do you respond to tardiness? As we said before, she came 5 minutes late. Jeff. Okay, here's the first scenario. He blew up because the waiter forgot to bring him water. Now, Andrea made Paul mad. So what does he do? He stops the car. I hope not in the middle of Pierre Koenig, you know. And he slams down the thing and throws the keys and says, "You drive. You drive yourself home." And this is overreacting. A lot of pointed out to Roy that he did something that wasn't perfect, maybe a little bit wrong. So the man starts panting. He can't control his breathing process. You know, he's about to, I don't know what, murder somebody. He's lost control. So again, normal people that you'll date will be impatient, but within normal bounds. They'll lose their temper moderately and occasionally. And stress doesn't overwhelm them. But those who cannot cope with stress, be very, very careful. Okay, man? If Eliezer, Eved Avram, tested Rivka as a potential marriage partner for Yitzchak, then we could follow suit. And within the context of dating, we could look, analyze, scrutinize, and weigh the possibilities of certain signs. If those behavior patterns are extreme and they repeat themselves, whether it's paranoia, I always think that, you know, I'm getting stabbed in the back, whether it's overreacting and getting angry at people, I can't deal with stressful situations, those are signs.
She was three. She trusted.
Right. 3 years old, maybe a little different.
Right.
Koso, kiso, and kaso. Next, aggressive behavior. Again, physically, that's upgrade. Nothing to talk about. Verbally aggressive. In marriage, he bullies other people. He calls them by names. He ridicules them. He puts them down. He uses force whenever he wants to. And while dating, he may be crude and combative towards others. Watch the way he drives. He's very aggressive. Well, if you come from New York, I don't think that proves anything. You know, on the contrary, if you're not an aggressive driver in that part of the world, I don't know, maybe you should see a shrink. But people are overly competitive, and he starts calling people by names. He verbally, he verbally abuses them. He sees a pedestrian who's walking slowly across the street, and he decides to call them names. He rolls down his window. Jeremy was politely told that the table he sat down at was reserved. Now look, I would get peeved myself, because why did you put a sign on the table that said reserved? I had no reason to believe it's reserved. But in some fancy restaurants, you don't go to a table until the waiter brings you over. So imagine the following scenario. He brought you over to a table, and then another waiter or the head waiter comes over and says, that's a reserved table. You feel very hurt. So what do? You start cursing the waiter? I mean, that's a problem. That's verbal aggression. Okay, Kurt is at a vending machine and the Coke just doesn't come out. Oh man, this has happened to me 1,001 times. So what do? Start kicking the machine. Bob looks for opportunities to smash his opponent during hockey games. Listen, when I went to a hockey game, if there weren't fights on the rink, I wanted my money back. So here I went to Madison Square Garden to watch the New York Rangers, and there was no fight on the rink. But if you're playing in your local thing, like the Canadians, you know, any Canadians here? You know, oh, we have some Canadians here. I mean, the Canadians, it's like hockey from, you know, after you wean off your mother's milk, you got to learn how to play hockey. You know, everyone's skating and everyone's this. If you don't live next door to a hockey rink, you know, you got to sell your house. So in Canada, imagine you raise a child to play hockey. It doesn't mean that the child has to be so aggressive that at the age of 9, he's already giving hat checks and throwing people off the rink. So sports, you know, we encourage children to play sports, but there's a limit. Sports should not become overly competitive and chashol, not violent. Tone it down. Play for the exercise. Chilutz atzamos, as we say in Rosh Chodesh. Or play for the sake of, if not exercise, the sake of the fun, of getting socially close to a person, team effort. There's so many beautiful stories you could read your children as they're growing up about playing sports. Find a way of educating them. And now we move on to page 5. And here we're going back, as you'll guess, immediately to Radcliffe. She wants to know what the parents are doing here. Why aren't we raising the right kinds of husbands? And again, she tells us what a gentleman is all about, a gentleman, and we've already expressed this in the past. His mood is even, he's pleasant, he speaks with respect for himself, respect for others, respect for Almighty God. He's kind, he's generous, he has a good sense of humor. Ah, halavai, we should raise our sons to have a good sense of humor, to be disciplined, to be controlled. I went to a wedding because, you know, I had to check out the, you know, the food. We did what they call te'ima, you know. So at this particular wedding, it was mostly French Moroccans. And I told my wife, we have to invite more Moroccans to our wedding because the food is definitely going to be Moroccan food. But in any event, but I was just amazed. I was watching hundreds of people at this wedding. They were so soft-spoken. They were so calm. I was this spoiled. And they were Israelis. I mean, originally French. Like, I couldn't believe it. I said, you know, I'm joining the Moroccan society or whatever it is. So these are gentlemen. These are people who are well-disciplined, who controlled, and they make the most wonderful marriage partners. If you can just find one, ladies, grab them. They're excellent parents. They're kind, they're generous, they're compassionate, they're forgiving, they're patient. They're well-mannered. This is the person who will lead his home. Listen to the poetry. He will lead his home, raise his family with wisdom, with self-control, with empathy, with an emotional sense of caring and sensitivity. This person is loved and respected, appreciated by all in his adult life. My father's a Zichrono Livracha, in his drushes used to always talk about a certain individual in the town of Plisa where he was raised. Close to a century ago, because my father would be well over 100 if he were alive. So back in the town of Plisa, there was one man who was, they didn't call him abusive because they didn't know the word abusive, but this man used to subjugate and oppress everyone. Nobody wanted to be near him. He would curse you, he was aggressive, he was a bully. Everyone hated him. And here we have a picture of a gentleman. Everybody loves him and respects him. They're gravitationally pulled to come to be close with him. And this is the person who makes a wonderful father and raises children in the proper Torah way. So steer clear of a potential abuser. Okay, we're back to Mandelson. So she says the following. Number one, he's very controlling and possessive. This, my lady friends, you got to be very careful about. If you meet a man who is controlling and possessive, two different words, not to be confused, but very closely related one to the other. They control and they possess. And this is the primary characteristic, she says, of an abusive personality. In marriage, he'll control every last detail of your life. He wants to know how you're spending your money. He wants to know where you're going. What are you doing where you are? If he calls you up on the cell phone and he hears some noise in the back, he wants to know what's going on in the back. He's suspicious. He doesn't want you to spend the money only the way he does. He totally controls your social life, your religious observance. Remember, we discussed last week about this woman who wasn't dressed in the way that her husband wanted her to dress, right? Her knees were not covered. Do you remember this discussion we had last week? For those who were here last week, well, you forgot it already.
No.
Oh, good. You got me scared there for a minute because, you know, if you forgot what I said last week, that's not good. You know? Although it could give you an extra class for next week, you know what I'm saying? So what happens while dating? Watch what goes on with this man. He's got tabs on you. He sends out the mafia or the detectives. You know, he's got somebody tagging you. He wants to know where you go. He wants to know how you spend your money, and then he tries to influence your behavior. He pushes the relationship in the way he wants it to go. It doesn't develop naturally. Marcy quotes someone's opinion. Avi insists that she disagree with it. Jerry decides where he and Rhonda would go. Couldn't care less where she wants to go. Evan resents that Donna wouldn't agree to marry her without his meeting her parents. So right after the meeting, he insisted they get engaged right away. The man is controlling, possessive. Normal people you date want to spend time with you, but they're not going to demand your time. They're interested in your life, but they respect your privacy. Sometimes they want to become intimate with you in marriage, and therefore they want to know everything. But that's okay in a normal relationship. You come back together, husband and wife, after a long day. She wants to know everything that happened in your life, you and hers. That's an emotional bonding. But if it's in a dating situation, if it's very extreme, if he doesn't respect your privacy, if he applies pressure to you, if it gets too extreme, and he doesn't give you space to develop yourself as a person in your own right, he may be a controlling, abusive personality. It's again one of those danger signs. And on page 6, going back to parents, in Radcliffe's frame of reference, I don't know if you can relate to this. I have trouble with this, frankly. But she claims that every child has a natural tendency to imitate one parent more than the other. For example, she says, most of us, this is a scenario that's being written by someone, a woman. She writes, now keep in mind, when we say you imitate or you take upon the personality traits of one parent or the other, we're specifically focusing on a case where husband and wife, father and mother, have two different personalities, very radically different. For example, you could have the case of a woman, a mother who's sensitive. She's got a calm and quiet temperament. The father is loud and excitable. Okay? He goes into a flare, into a rage. And she writes the following. This is somebody writing to her, describing her situation. Growing up with this mother and this father. Most of us kids were very much like our mother. Okay? We were sensitive. We were mild-mannered. In other words, we took on We imitated her temperament, her quiet and controlled temperament. So we were calm. She encouraged those traits in us. In other words, it wasn't just that we watched her and tried to imitate her, but she also verbally taught us. She would teach us the Geres HaRamban. The Ramban's main thesis there is against anger, to be calm and not to be excitable. She would do it around the table every Shabbos and pointing to the midos that Hashem expected us. She never criticized Father directly. She was trying to reach him as well. He's a rageaholic. I never knew that word. He's never absorbed the lessons of the Ramban, and none of us respected him. Terrible thing. Some of my siblings actually hated him. We all worked very hard never to be that way, and Baruch Hashem, we turned out different than my father, similar to my mother. You know, in this case, I would say the laws of Kibbutz Aveim and Lashon Hara would require that the names be omitted. But it's a very painful situation. But the children had a natural tendency to imitate the mother, gravitate to the mother, and her personality traits dominated amongst the children. We're back now to the dating situation. Notice a power-hungry, manipulative individual. Again, you're seeing a pattern here that repeats itself. He makes you into an object. He exploits you. Even uses religion to dominate you. Be careful. Sometimes he make a comment about religion and he's sincere about it, but other times he's using religion as a method of dominating you. He seeks revenge against anyone he feels wronged him. So while dating, you should take a look and take interest. He may display, let's read the text. He says, he may display great interest in how much money you or your parents have. Why is he so interested in figuring out how much money you have?
Because he wants to learn.
Okay, maybe. What?
Kest,
okay, maybe. But, you know, he should have found out through the shadchan way before that. This is not a shadchanis that we're talking about. All right? Okay. Josh knew Amy was Shomer Negir, but he pressured her to become physical. Okay? That's indicative of a manipulative behavior pattern. And she may want to fool herself. When Petty told Nathan that she needed her car back early than he had thought was necessary, he deliberately returned it late. Yeah, I don't know how she knows that. Another driver cuts Avner off. Remember we said, watch the way he drives. So somebody cuts him off. So Avner goes back and cuts him off. And then he deliberately drives slowly, watching the guy behind him in his rear view mirror with a big smile on his face. You know, he's got his tongue hanging out. You know, like the wolf will just ate the fish. You know what I'm saying? And Julie wants to break up with Phil and he threatens to badmouth her. I mean, again, hopefully Julie doesn't want to get involved with Phil, but this is the kind of relationship. So watch out for men who like to rule. And now we get back to parents. And here's a very difficult situation that's described here. My husband and I both come from dysfunctional families. Both of us. Maybe they're a good shidduch, I don't know. But they're not going to necessarily make good parents. We didn't bring good skills into our marriage. And what we did in front of the children, we slammed doors. We said horrible things to each other. We would fight in front of the children.
Sure.
And she says, I was terrified for them. I knew that unless we did something, they would end up having lives as miserable as ours. Because I couldn't help myself, my husband couldn't even try to help himself. But there's one thing that I can do to help for my kids, is to get help for them. I know they need it. I've arranged for them and all of us to go to family counseling. I want my children to learn that people have to try to change when something isn't right. This is a sad scenario. Children imitate patterns that they see at home, especially when it comes to communication. And if they see parents speaking in a certain way, where those parents are speaking to them, to the children, to others, to help in the family, you know, they have a maid in the family, or they speak to relatives, to other people, children absorb this subconsciously. All of psychology tells us over and over again how much the behavior of the parents impact on the children. Sometimes in a subconscious way, they internalize it. What does it mean they internalize it? Look at the next two paragraphs. If there's anything that will bring you to tears, it's the next two paragraphs. A child may hate the way her mother screams, and yet, a couple of decades later, she finds herself screaming in the very same way. The screaming pattern has been installed, injected into her brain. But sometimes you have the exact opposite response. The youngster may grow up to be quiet, to be a controlled communicator. In other words, the child is responding to go from one extreme to the other because he or she sees the yelling and the screaming. So the screaming pattern manifests itself in a different way. It's the same pattern, but in a totally different way. Whenever she hears someone raise her voice, she becomes physically sick. Her internal world holds back the scream. She relates to a scream in a traumatic way, affecting her relationships at home and at work throughout her life. How tragic is it when parents present and portray those kind of patterns, repeating it over and over again, the screaming patterns. This is dysfunctional communication that engenders emotional dysfunctioning people. And again, this someone who cannot empathize. Notice, he's oblivious to your needs, to your feelings. He doesn't care how his behavior impacts upon you. He's totally insensitive. He'll be unable to relate intimately on a consistent basis. While dating, he claims that he heard something hurtful, he's indifferent, he's inconsiderate. Some people on dates are very stingy. You know, a girl wants to ask her, you know, him to get her a drink, so if you're lucky, he'll get her a cup of water. Right? No, these are problems that should be noticed. He's inconsiderate, he's disrespectful. He's even cruel to animals. Okay, let's notice the way he treats animals. You know, Chazal says so much about Moshe Rabbeinu and the way he treats animals, and that was indicative of his soft, compassionate personality. Alex laughed in a strange, excited way when Sharon recounted someone's humorous misfortune. So again, it doesn't sound like she was so great talking about misfortune, but he was laughing, he was excited. And he would shrug his shoulders and say, life goes on. Or he must have deserved it. There was no compassion whatsoever. Eric crosses the street. Beth notices that he kicks a passing cat. Whoa, this guy is sick. Normal people may sometimes lack sensitivity, but they feel for others. And if they hurt your feelings, they don't mean to do it. It's not out of meanness. It may be out of ignorance. But if you see these patterns repeating themselves over and over again. And now we get back to Radcliffe on page 8. She talks again about how parents have to be very careful, especially about communication techniques, being calm. And if they see that at a particular moment or juncture they're getting angry and they're overreacting, it's so important that they calm themselves down and get involved in self-soothing activities. Okay, we'll see what this means in just a minute. If you can Hold on to page 8. And fast forward for a moment to page 10. Children learn by seeing and doing. Show them, teach them how to calm themselves down when they feel frustrated, when they feel annoyed, when they're disappointed. And she gives four techniques. Number one, remove yourself from the conversation. In other words, if things are getting out of hand, let your children see that you make a comment like, let's continue later, that you're controlling your anger. Or, as we said before, get involved in something, an activity that's calming. I mean, for some people, cooking or cleaning. I guess not too many. Well, all right. Maybe one person. Exercise. The exercise calm you down? Usually, I think. Music, exactly. Meditation. That's an interesting approach. You got to read Rabbi Kaplan's book on meditation. Engage in a hobby or craft. Then they have those, what do they call those things? The
stress balls.
Stress balls they call them? No, there's another name for it. Those cubes, what do they call them? Anyway.
Rubik cubes.
Yeah, do your thing, you know what I mean? My father-in-law, you know, pushes, you know, squeezes this thing to get a grip, you know. Get a grip on yourself, right? Call a friend. I mean, that's not going to calm you down. Okay, get involved in some work. Maybe write a sefer. People write sefer for all sorts of different reasons. Make aliyah. That's going to calm you down. Okay, so you get into this automatic fight or flight response. You got to cool off. Number three, return to finish the conversation. In other words, let your children see that you were all to hits, you know, you were very excited, you were in a state of almost rage, you calmed yourself, you cooled yourself off, and then you came back to complete the conversation. Very important for the children to see that. And now you're speaking quietly and calmly. And teach your children to do the same. Not enough that they see it, that they witness it. It's got to be, as we say, it's Erev Pesach, V'gadatol v'bincha. It's got to be Haggadah v'peh. Parents have to lead by example, but that's insufficient. The strategy requires that parents teach. To raise a son to become a gentleman, parents must set clear and strong boundaries in the home. And here, just to complete it, we'll go back to page 8. And if you can hold on to these pages, again, not next Tuesday, but the one after, we'll believe it, we'll finish this up. But compulsive. This, I think, in my humble opinion, is the most important danger signal of abusive behavior. People who make demands that are totally unrealistic. And again, we all are suffering from this. But hopefully, you know, it's not out of hand. Unreasonable expectations. Okay? When Alicia suggested a change in venue for their date, Bob got very upset. Now look at this. Rivki shows up in a skirt, and Mordechai thought it was too short. He was nasty and cold the entire evening. Ari shamed Stacy for not making a frum enough impression, insisting that she incorporate more Yiddish and Yeshivish into her speech. Okay, I mean, you know, these are unrealistic demands. But I had in mind something else. Just give me a second here. I guess it's on a different paragraph, which I'm not finding now. Where is that paragraph about unrealistic demands on someone's time? Okay. Not finding it now. But she has a whole presentation here about people in marriage that want to dominate their spouse's time in a very unrealistic way. So that would probably fit here into people who have unrealistic expectations. They get extremely disappointed, they become furious, things don't go as they think they should go. Oh, here, this is very important. With this we'll conclude. On page 8, the paragraph, he is compulsive in marriage, on line 4, I would like you to underline this, and making you feel guilty. That's a heavy one. This, I think, is one of the most difficult challenges in marriage.
That's every Jewish mother.
Well, if that's the case, then maybe that's why we understand why so many of our sons are feeling shameful and are feeling guilty. They're down on themselves and they respond with abusive behavior. So we got to improve this. So if that's your negative view of your mother, then we have to improve that picture. Not your mother. I mean, everyone else's mother, except for yours. Okay, good. Okay. But I'm saying, a mother should be very careful not making her son or her daughter feel guilty. Yes, we have to improve. Yes, we have to discipline our children. Absolutely, we have to discipline our children. That's going to be the subject of Rosh Hashem of next discussion. But even as we discipline our children, always to respect them. Always to give them a great sense of self. Always to emphasize the fantastic potential that they have. The amazing neshama that they are. I know people here in Israel who call their children neshama. That's how they talk to them. And just, again, it may sound, you know, may sound mechanical and external, but if you get into the shmung of it, it's an automatic, you know, it kind of it preempts, you know, getting angry at the child. You know, if you calm yourself down by calling your child a neshama, and you always think of the pintle yid and the fact that they have a beautiful neshama, and you don't have to heap guilt on them. They have to know when they're misbehaving. They have to be challenged and have to improve their behavior and their moral structure and fiber. But this is not all about guilt. And when a person is overridden with guilt, they can chas v'shalom become abusive personalities. So Yiratzon, let's end with the tefillah that we should be zocheh to raise children who are going to be great husbands, loving, caring, compassionate, that ideal father for your children and for our children. Ken Yiratzon.
Amen. Guys, if you stick around, we have a reading from us.